conste de ninguém questo libro The Strangeness of Her Face, Their Pride and Loved One to the Great Blind King. The reason he loved a fallen mighty man, and the stately care one woman wants to feel. Who now hopes nothing to accept from life, but all sees only hope to her one child. They parted from her with painful burdens past, helpless against the choice of Savitri's heart. They left her to her
Good morning, everyone. We are reading in Book 7, the Book of Yoga, Canto 1, which has a long name, The Joy of Union, The Ordeal of the Foreknowledge of Death, and The Heart's Grief and Pain. Savitri has chosen to marry Satyavan, and this first canto starts with her marriage procession, taking her from her palace home to the hermitage in the woods. There are seats here. A speed of armored squadrons and a voice far heard of chariots bore her from her home into the forest where her parents and all the retinue, they hand Savitri over to Satyavan's parents, the old blind king and the stately, careworn woman, once a queen. I'm not sure where we stopped last time. Jocelyn, can you tell me? Okay, so they have not yet handed over Savitri. We'll continue reading from there, from line 74 on page 467. Amitoj, will you begin?
Arrived in that rough-hewn homestead they gave, questioning no more the strangeness of her fate, their pride and loved one to the great blind king, a regal pillar of foreign mightiness, and the stately careworn woman, once a queen, who now hoped nothing for herself from life, but all things only hoped for her one, calling on that single head from partial fate, all joy of earth, all heaven's gratitude, adoring wisdom and beauty, like a young god, she saw him, loved by heaven, as by herself. She rejoiced in his brightness and believed in his faith, and knew not of the evil born in her.
Thank you. I think we'll pause there. Jinhee, you can put a chair, take those cushions off this chair, and put this chair a little forward. So we're reading in Book 7, the Book of Yoga, Canto 1. We've reached page 467, and we just now read from line 74, arrived in that rough-hewn homestead, down to line 86. We'll have a look at that in a moment when everybody's had time to read it quietly to themselves. So the marriage procession has come to the forest, the Shalva forest, to the hermitage where the exiled king Dyumatsena is living with his wife and his son Satyavan. Savitri has chosen to marry Satyavan. She and her family have been warned that in 12 months' time, Satyavan must die. But nobody else knows that, and they are keeping it to themselves. So they've all arrived in that rough-hewn homestead. It's a very simple place, peat huts and grass. Well, she's come from a palace. Now she will lead a very, very different life. So her parents hand over their pride and loved one to that great blind king, Dyumatsena. Sri Aurobindo describes him as a regal pillar of fallen mightiness, and his wife, the stately, careworn woman, once a queen. Now she has to take care of her husband and her son in that forest environment. She doesn't have people to help her. So she's still stately like a queen, but she's become careworn. Her husband is blind. Yes. And Sri Aurobindo tells us that she no longer hopes for anything for herself in life. All her hopes are centered on her one child, Satyavan. And all her prayers are for him. She's calling on that single head from partial fate, all joy of earth, all heaven's beatitude. She wants him to have earthly happiness and heavenly happiness, heavenly blessings also. And of course, like all mothers, she adores her son. But we will find out that she has really reason to worship Satyavan. He's such a special person. She's adoring wisdom and beauty like a young god's. So she sees him blessed with these wonderful qualities. She saw him loved by heaven as by herself. She rejoiced in his brightness and believed in his fate and knew not of the evil drawing near. We know. We are the readers. We are aware what is coming. But nobody else knows. I think it's all clear, no? Nobody needs to ask anything. Larry, would you read?
Lingering some days upon the forest verge, like men who lengthen out departure's pain, unwilling to separate sorrowful clinging hands, unwilling to see for the last time the face, heavy with the sorrow of a coming day, and wondering at the carelessness of fate, who breaks with idle hands her supreme works. They parted from her with pain-fraught, burdened hearts, as forced by inescapable fate we part from one whom we shall never see again, driven by the singularity of her fate, helpless against the choice of Savitri's heart. They left her to her rapture and her doom in the tremendous forest savage charge. All put behind her that was once her life, all welcome that henceforth was his and hers. She abode with Satyavan in the wild woods. priceless, she deemed her joy so close to death. Apart with love, she lived for love alone. As if self-poised above the march of days, her immobile spirit watched the haste of time, a statue of passion and invincible force, an absolutism of sweet, imperious will, a tranquility and a violence of the gods, indomitable and immutable.
Thank you. So most of what we've read today and what we read last week corresponds to the unfolding of the traditional legend. Sri Aurobindo tells it in a narrative style, and it's the unfolding. It's a narrative. But you might notice that in the last sentence of the section, he gives us a clue as to the very special being that Savitri is. He's linking the traditional legend with the deeper purpose of his poem. He describes Savitri poised in herself, her spirit, above the march of days, above the unrolling of time. Her immobile spirit watched the haste of time, the passing of the moments. Her spirit is like a statue, immobile, firm, but full of passion, intense feeling, and invincible force. She is an embodiment of the supreme conscious force of the Lord. So she's carrying this unconquerable force in her. And this spirit has a sweet, imperious will. Those are two words we don't often find together. Somebody who's imperious is usually not very sweet. And this absolutism of her will, that's imperious. When she's decided, it will be done. But at the same time, there's a tranquility, a calm, a silence, as well as a violence, an intensity and force of the gods that is indomitable and immutable. Indomitable is like invincible. It can't be conquered. Immutable, it will not change. So this is one of the passages where we get a powerful evocation of Savitri's true being. Anybody has anything else they would like to ask about the earlier passage?
Just I tell you, in the agenda of the mother, maîtrise, he conquers, not conquers, but he stops the fighting with Kali. But mother stays, what you said, so immobile, so funky. It's very, very interesting.
That's the characteristic of the higher power, no? That it is not disturbed. He uses the word violence, but it's a different kind of violence. Yes. So we'll go on. Mihong.
At first, to her beneath the sapphire heavens, the serene solitude was a gorgeous dream, an altar of the summer's splendor and fire, a sky-topped flower-hung palace of the gods. and all its saints a smile on rapturous lips, and all its voices bars of happiness. There was a chanting in the casual wind. There was a glory in the least sunbeam. Night was a Christ of praise on velvet cloth, a lessening darkness, or a moonlit deep. Day was a purple pageant and a hymn, a wave of the laughter of light from morn to eve. His essence was a dream of a memory. His presence was the empire of a love, a fusing of the joys of earth and heaven, a tremulous blaze of rapture past, a rushing of two spirits to be one, a burning of two bodies in one flame. Open to a gate of unforgettable bliss, two lives were locked within an earthly heaven, and fate and grief fled from that fiery hour.
Thank you. So this is the joy of union. This is the first experience when everything around seems to reflect the joy of the coming together of Savitri and Satyavan.
What this means,
chrysoprase? It's a golden gemstone. So it's a picture of the moon shining golden on the velvet of the dark sky. Sylvan forest. But this nuptial rapture does not last very long. No? Just as the summer does not last very long. The season changes and the mood changes. Ganga Lakshmi, would you read?
But soon now fell the summer's ardent breath, and throngs of blue-black clouds crept to the sky, and the rain fled sobbing over the weeping leaves, and storm became the forest's titan voice. Then, listening to the thunder's fatal crash and the fugitive tattering footstep of the showers and the long unsatisfied panting of the wind, and so muttering in the sound-vexed night, the relief of all the world came near to earth. Night, darkness seems a future on ominous face. The shadow of a lover's wing arose, and fade red shines open her mortal heart. The moments shift and restless race, alarm her thoughts, her mind remembering Narad's day.
Thank you. The grief of all the world came near to her. And time seems to be passing too quickly. The moments, swift and ruthless race, they're passing like that. And she remembers the date that Narad has given. As if we look carefully, Sri Aurobindo uses all the resources, I would say the enriched resources of modern poetry. He drew on the symbolist movement that grew up in in France in the second half of the 19th century. And so he enriched all his knowledge of all the other literatures with that way of fusing physical reality with inner reality. This is an example of it. We'll go on. Andras, you read.
A trembling moved accountant of her riches, she reckoned the insufficient days between. A dire expectancy knocked at her breast, dreadful to her were the footstep of the hours. Grief came, a passionate stranger to her gate, banished when in his arms, out of her sleep, it rose at morn to look into her face. Vainly she fled into abysms of bliss from her pursuing foresight of the end. The more she plunged into love, that anguish grew. Her deepest grief from the sweetest gulfs arose. Remembrance was a poignant pang. She felt each day a golden leaf torn, curled out from her too slender root of love and joy. Thus, swaying in strong gusts of happiness and swimming in foreboding somber waves, and feeling sorrow and terror with her heart, for now they sat among her bosom's guests, or in her inner chamber paced apart. Her eyes stared blind into the future's night.
Thank you. Anything to share or ask about this? Very, very poignantly, he makes us feel this state where she's tossed between strong gusts of happiness and swimming in the somber, the dark waves of foreboding, the dread of what is coming. Yes, Don?
This is a question of what is coming there. I'm not clear. Satyavan knows what's coming?
No. In this environment, she is the only one who knows. And that's what he's going to speak about next. Mathilde.
Out of her separate self, she looked and saw, moving amid the unconscious faces loved, in mind a stranger, though in heart so new, an ignorant smiling word so happily guide upon its way towards an unknown doom, and wondered at the careless lives of men. As if in different words they woke, though close, the confidence of the returning sun, they wrapped in little falling hopes and paths. She, in her dreadful knowledge, was alone. The rich and happy secrecy that once enshrined her as if in a silver bower apart, in the brightness of thoughts and dreams, made room for tragic hours of solitude and lonely grief that none could share or know. A body seeing the end too soon of joy and the fragile happiness of its mortal life.
Thank you.
My question is
answered. Yeah, it's often like that. And then he continues his description of Savitri and her feelings. You read.
Her quiet, insistent, and quiet and calm, her graceful daily art were now a mask. In vain she looked upon her, deep to find a ground of stillness, and the spirit speaks, steal wealth from her for the silent being within, who sees life's drama pass with unmoved eyes, supports the sorrow of the mind and heart, and bears in human grace the world and fate. Her gleams or flashes came, the presence was heat. Only her violent heart and passionate will were pushed in front to meet the immutable doom. Defenseless, mute, bound to a human lodge, they had no means to act, no way to save.
Thank you. So this is the human Savitri. He showed us her spirit, no? Self-poised above the march of the days. But for the moment, that is veiled from her, this silent being within. So, although she doesn't give any outward sign, all her graceful daily acts are a mask for this sorrow that she's carrying, and disturbance. It says that she looks in vain into her depths to find a ground of stillness, of calm, no? And the spirit's peace. She's not feeling that at all. Some glimpse or flashes of that presence within comes, but the presence itself was hidden. So she's got her human resources, her passionate, intense heart, and her will. These are put in front. This is what she's facing, her unchangeable doom, the fate that's coming. And they are not really strong enough, no? She feels defenseless, naked, unprotected, bound, tied to her human lot. So her heart and her will find no way to act. They can't save her.
This reminds me of our reading just a few pages back about the people who come to do a big service to humankind, and they all have had to go through being human and being...
To share the human lot.
Especially awful.
Yes, yes. Yes, Prashid.
Or the presence with capital.
This is the divine presence, the indwelling spirit. No?
Also in the page before, what was for me also stirring me was that in mind is stranger, though in heart so near. So the in heart she is with the...
With the world. Yes.
In mind, it's a stranger, so there is a...
The separation in consciousness.
Yeah.
No? So, this is the ignorant, smiling world. She feels very, very close to the whole world in her heart, but there's such a difference between her knowledge and their knowledge. And she knows that she can't share it. This is one of the poignant points. But at the same time, she's amazed at how thoughtless people are, the careless lives of men. People just go on with their little hourly hopes and tasks, unaware of the greater, more significant realities.
The mask is a
persona. Well, we wear a mask when we want to disguise ourselves.
Yeah.
No, so she is not showing to anyone. It's all. She's showing this gracious self,
yeah.
But it's a kind of actor's mask, a disguise.
Yeah. It's a persona.
Yeah.
Mm.
So he's going to speak a little bit more about that mask now. So speaking about the heart and the will and all this turmoil within, he says she controlled these things. You'll read, dear. Yeah.
These she controlled. Nothing was shown outside. She was still to them, the child that knew, the child they knew and loved. The sorrowing woman they saw not within. No change was in her beautiful motions seen. A worshipped empress, all ones wait to serve. She made herself the diligent self of all. Nor spared the labor of broom and jar and well, or close gentle tending, or to heat the fire of altar and kitchen. No slight task allowed to others that her woman's strength might do. In all her acts, a strange divinity shone. Into a simplest movement, she could bring a oneness with earth's glowing rod of light, a lifting up of common acts by love. All love was hers, and its one heavenly call bound all to all with her as golden dove. But when her grief to the surface pressed too close, these things, once gracious, adjacent of her joy, seemed meaningless to her, a gleaming shell, or were around mechanical and void. Her body's actions shared not by her will.
Thank you. So even in this state, in all her acts, a strange divinity shone. Into a simplest movement, she could bring a oneness with earth's glowing robe of light, a lifting up of common acts by love. And then the next two lines, all love was hers, and its one heavenly cord bound all to all with her as golden tie. This is the whole world that she's carrying in her love. But when the grief becomes too strong, then all his outer acts seem meaningless, a gleaming shell or a mechanical void round. Her body's actions shared not by her will. She's not identified with them. The will is occupied with something else. Earth's growing robe of light seems to be the love robe or the Ananda robe. We are conscious of Earth's physical sheath, and then there's a life sheath and a mind sheath, but around that there's a sheath of love and bliss, the divine presence. That's what it represents, yes. Bom, will you read?
Always behind this strange divine
all night she walked through the slow silent hour, living in the pleasure of the illusion and faith. Where the sleep on the beauty of the visible world and sent your own cheek to the sea. Waking at morn or leaf, endlessly drawn to sleep. On being able to separate again, swallowed that tiny grain of that lingering joy. On willing to lose in the body from her breath. The warm and delicate signs that love must lose.
Thank you. I'm very fond of this line, the warm, inadequate signs that love must use. And I'm engaged at the moment in a study. I'm making a comparison between the first version that we have of Savitri from 1916 and this version. And so I can tell you that this line about the warm, inadequate signs is there right from the very beginning. It's really very surprising, because Sri Aurobindo said that he went on working and working and working to raise the inspiration of this thing and all up to the same level. But it's surprising what a number of lines like this he has kept all the way through. They were perfect from the beginning. Alice, you would like to go on?
Intolerant of the poverty of time, her passion catching at the fugitive hours, willed the expanse of centuries in one day of prodigal love and the surf of ecstasy. Or else she strove even in mortal time to build a little room for timelessness and a deep union to human lives. Her soul secluded, shut into his soul. After all was given, she demanded still, even by his strong embrace and satisfied. She longed to cry, oh, tender such a one, oh, lover of my soul, give more of love while yet thou canst. To her thou lovest, imprint thyself on every nerve to keep that thrills to be the message of my heart. For soon we part, and who shall know how long before the great wheel in its monstrous round restores us to each other, and our love, too long she loved to speak faithful word. Made her good on his happy day. She pressed the outsurging grief back into the breast to dwell within sight and hope alone.
Thank you. So this is the intensity of conjugal love, no? Of married love. That was the theme of the traditional legend. And very, very poignantly and convincingly, Sri Aurobindo shows it to us. Who's next, Prasad? Oh, all right, yes, please read. Yes.
Shama.
Your Shama. Yes, please read. Yes.
Satyavan sometimes half understood, or felt at least with uncertain answer of a thought blinded hearts, the unuttered need, the unplumbed abyss of a deep passionate want. All of his speeding days that he could spare from labor in the forest hewing wood and hunting food in the wild sylvan glades, and service to his father's sightless life, he gave to her and helped to increase the hours by the nearness of his presence and his clasp, and lavish softness of heart-seeking words, and the close beating felt of heart on heart. All was too little for her bottomless need. If in his presence she forgot a while, grief filled his absence with its aching touch. She saw the desert of her coming days, imaged in every solitary hour. Although with a vain imaginary bliss, a fiery union through death's door of escape, she dreamed of a body robed in funeral flame. She knew she must not clutch that happiness to die with him and follow, seizing his rope, across our other countries, travelers glad into the sweet or terrible beyond. For those sad parents still would need her here to help the empty remnant of the day. Often it seemed to her the age's pain had pressed their quintessence into a single womb, concentrating in her a tortured world.
Thank you.
I think all this is a symbol of sadhana also. Sri Aurobindo has cast it in the symbol of his lovers, but it's like they used to, I read about Mirabai, she would go up into ecstasy and then she would cry like that. So it is like the union, and then you can't sustain it and it falls, she would fall back into grief, but in this case it was because her husband was going to die, but the ego loses the contact and it's like that, right? Because otherwise, how can we totally relate to it? You know, if we don't have a
yes,
spouse,
he. This is what of. This is his task throughout this poem, is to convey to us things we wouldn't normally experience and don't experience. So, how these high states, these intense states, how can he make them near and close and feelable, imaginable to us? So he's a master at that.
You know? It's such a beautiful phrase here, unplumbed abyss.
Yes.
Unplumbed.
Yes.
And this part, strange as it may seem, it struck me that it's like the temptation of suicide that people think, oh, if I just get out of it, then life will be better. But she feels that temptation, but then she knows it's not to be done. This is a vain imaginary bliss of fiery youth through death's door of escape. She dreamed of her body.
And we can, yes, we can think, as Shama says, that at that time it was a normal thing, no, for the wife, a noble wife, to accompany her husband to the funeral pyre. But for her, that's not a solution, because she can't follow that, that kind of selfish solution to follow with him, because she has to take care of the helpless parents, no?
Nowadays, today, that we have to help the whole world. I mean, to
yes, there are other reasons, yes. But in this context, I think he gives a certain beautiful significance to the sacrifice of sati.
To what Piti just also said to me, it came also the special love between Savitri and Satyavan is that they are both connected to the divine, and this is the bliss which is giving the real, the intensity and the fire. Ne? And so when I remember that Sri Aurobindo said, when we reach the divine union, then is this intensity there, the bliss there. Mm. And that is also that she has to go to find her soul, to heal, to have it totally in her being.
But I think poetically, in the context of the poem, in this one canto, only in this one canto, Sri Aurobindo is showing us the human Savitri, the one who has to go through all the suffering and the intensity. And that's so beautifully done. It's,
and
I think,
it's the human mother, which we read just before. The human mother.
Yes, yeah.
But it keeps bringing in this that she's taking on all the pain of the world.
Yes.
So it kind of universalizes it.
Yes.
So it kind of reminds us of him.
Yes.
Yeah, symbolically, Savitri is the emanation, Divine Mother has come to save the soul, Satyavan.
Yeah.
So that's how I'm trying to think of it in my mind. Otherwise, it's.
But he says it's not just an allegory. No, these are real emanations, and we can have a human contact with them. It's so that gives a much richer dimension than if we just think, oh, she's the Divine Mother and he's the soul. He shows us this aspect which is there in the legend of the conjugal love, which I'm sure he himself experienced also. He knew about that.
But I mean, from a very human perspective, I'm thinking, what if a person decides that they want to commit suicide because their life problem is so bad? But then she considers, you see, how sad her parents would be. Do people who want to commit suicide think about the mess
that
they're
behind? That's something completely different. Yeah.
So there's a responsibility there. She has a sense of it.
Here the line says, but Satyavan sometimes thought understood, so he started to understand what's going on in her.
He's feeling, you know, because he loves her, somehow he half understood. He doesn't know why she's feeling so intensely, but he feels that need. And that's why, as far as possible, Sri Aurobindo says, he felt at least something of that unplumbed abyss, that deep gulf of her deep passionate want, her need to be with him. And so, of course, he has his duties and his life to live and all the rest, but whatever time he can spare, he gives to her. Yes.
But I was wondering why she kept the secret within her instead of discussing with him and say how we can face the pain.
She didn't want him to suffer.
Why can't we solve this together?
Well, that's not the way the story goes. I mean, nowadays perhaps we have to do this. People get told that they have a death sentence hanging over their head in one way or another, and then they discuss how to deal with it. But Sri Aurobindo's following the traditional story in all its symbolism, and as we will see, this canto here is the prelude to Savitri taking up her yoga, her tapasya. And it's in this deep intensity, just like at the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, it's that complete helplessness and bewilderment of Arjuna that is the opening through which the yoga of the Gita can be worked out. No. So this is setting the scene in the same way. Yeah. So you can read now, Prasad, please.
Thus, in silent chamber of her soul, fostering her love to live with great grief, she dwelt like a dumb priest with hidden gods, unappeased by the wordless offering of her days, lifting to them her sorrow like frankincense. Her life, the altar, herself, the sacrifice. Yet, ever they grew in each other's womb, until it seemed no power could rend apart. Since even the body's walls could not divide, for when he wandered in the forest of her conscious spirit walk with him anew, his action as if in herself he moved, he less aware, filled with her from afar, always the stature of her passion grew. Grief, fear became the food of mighty love. Increased by torment, it filled the whole world. It was all her life, became her whole earth and heaven.
Thank you. It's as if within herself she has a secret room, you know? And there she keeps her love and her grief. And it's as if she's a priest who every day has to perform the rituals and the offerings to these hidden gods. And somehow whatever offering she makes, it's not enough. They are unappeased. These demanding gods she's got in her heart, love and grief. And earth, I think, is there also. So she has to lift her sorrow. It's like frankincense, the incense, no? And her life is the altar, and she herself is the sacrifice. So I'm reminded of the last page of Canto 1, where it tells us that when she wakes up in the morning, in the shadow of her heart, there's a being there, a stone still figure of high and godlike pain. And he's waiting, unappeased, same word. The daily oblation, the daily sacrifice of her unwept tears. So it's another beautiful way of expressing the same image. She's offering this sacrifice of controlled grief every day.
It's very interesting, Shalavan, what you said, control grief. This morning I listened to the Sidhir Dhamma, 1965. She tells, you know, full knowledge when you are master of life and death. Yeah. Alors, suddenly I understand that. It's very, very master of life and death. So, it's very, very, very.
I was thinking this passage also a symbol of the relation of sun and earth, because Mother talks about the diminution of the light all the way down to 25th December. And then she says it begins to grow. So it's like, you know, it's fated. He says, you know, the loss of the light is fated and then it has to come back up. So it's like, it's an individual story, it's a cosmic story, both together, huh? Because that cycle in time, you cannot just, you can't change that, no? It happens every year. No.
Let's try and reach the end of the canto. You will read, yes?
Also like form and instant of the hours, immortal, equal, unslayable, and testable. Her spirit stretched measureless in strength divine. An anchor for the blows of fate and time, or tired of sorrow's passionate luxury. Grief self became calm, dull-eyed, desolate, awaiting some issue of its fiery struggle, some deed in which it might forever cease, victorious over itself and death and tears. The ear now calls upon the brink of change. No more the storms sail with stupendous wings, and thunders float in wrath across the world. But still was heard a muttering in the sky, and went gradually through the mournful air, and grey slow drifting clouds shutting the earth. So her grief's heavy sky shut in her heart. A still self hid behind, but gave no light. No voice came down from the forgotten heights. Only the privacy of its brooding pain, her human heart spoke to the body's fate.
Thank you. When she arrived, it was summer. And then the rains came and the beginning of all this trouble and suffering. And now the rains are coming to an end. And we will see next time we'll start the beginning of her yoga. And when she reaches the end of her yoga, the year is over, it is summer again. Take away this grief from me.
Does that have to be forgotten in her mission?
This is Savitri, the princess who's grown up in the palace. She's not aware. Not aware of her inner mission yet.
One second, you forgot, no? But Savitri, she forgot her divine.
Well, that spirit is there watching over her, but she hasn't yet become conscious of it. She's like us. All of us have come with a mission. And the preparation is to allow life to wake us up to that discovery of the soul. That's
doing yoga and she realized?
Yes. That's what this book is about, the whole process of Savitri becoming aware, and then learning what she needs to know in order to fulfill the mission. And then she gets tested. How well have you learned your lesson? So we'll begin that journey with Savitri next week.
They gave, questioning no more the strangeness of her face, their pride and loved one to the great blind king. The regal pillar of fallen mightiness, and the stately care worn woman once supreme, who now hoped nothing for herself from life, but all things only hope for her one child. They parted from her with painful, burdened heart, helpless against the choice of Savitri's heart. They left her to her rapture and her doom. Close. gentle tending, or to heed the fast of altar and kitchen. No slight task allowed to others that her woman's strength might do.